Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Steve's Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great.
So you know how I read all sorts of food things, all sorts of things on the right, all sorts of things on the left?
Yes.
Looking through The Economist.
Yeah.
As I know you were as well.
Yes, sir.
And there's an article that says, why ethical food harms the planet. Right.
Why it harms the planet?
Yeah.
Because bad people grow ethical food?
No. The idea is look, I believe that free markets have a great place in the global democracy, mm-hmm. in our global economy. And I believe that free markets have a place, but not every place. And the answer to somebody else's not free market is not necessarily to open yours. There was an article...
hold on. You just glazed right over something that I think that...
I'm coming back to it.
Okay, but you can't glaze over that point.
Right, like when we have a free market but we're dealing with a country who doesn't, I need to let their stuff come into my market when they don't let my stuff go into their market?
Free market. No matter what you do in that situation, you don't have a free market.
But what The Economist would always argue is, well, let their stuff into yours and then they'll see the light.
But hold on, I was an economist.
Yeah, no. So but I mean, The Economist,
the magazine,
and right. and a lot, and I don't think that's always the answer. Anyway, mm-hmm. farming is very complicated, and as we talked about on this show, buying to have a point. In other words, I want to buy organic for a number of reasons. One, it's healthier, and two, I think it's better for the planet. I want to buy locally. Well, because I get better food that way, and mm-hmm. it's better than the planet. The Economist basically argues in this in the December 9th, 2006 Economist in their article entitled "Good Food." If you think you can make the planet better by clever shopping, think again. You might make it worse. What it says basically is trying to effect change by buying different foods, by buying organically or locally, is just a feel-good measure, and it's not that easy. Their first point is that farming... Here's a dummy talking. Farming is inherently bad for the environment. Since humans took it up around 11,000 years ago, the result has been deforestation on a massive scale. Yeah, farming's
so
bad
I say we
for
give
the
it,
planet.
So I say we give it up. That's what I say, Francis. Give up farming, back to foraging,
so what he's saying
hunting
is that,
and gathering. That's it for us.
But hold on a second. Farming was doomed and was doing all this damage to the planet until, he says... But following the Green Revolution of the 60s, which was the chemical revolution of the 60s, greater use of chemical fertilizers has tripled grain yields with very little increase in the area of land under cultivation.
You've heard us talk about this with experts on the show over and over and over and over again. Okay? The problem in the world right now is not a food shortage.
Right.
We have plenty of food to feed the people in the world today. The problem is getting that food to the people who need it and water.
And also, if you have the land grown that intensively on smaller parcels of land, but you're destroying those parcels of land.
Right, never to be able to use again.
He says taking land and making it farmland is destroying the land because you remove the... Where I'm saying farms integrated into the landscape, any idiot knows, work well in as a part of an ecosystem.
Right, but when you put a pig farm, and I'll use a pig farm, that is so intensive
right.
with the number of animals that you have in one tiny little area.
If you've got 150 pigs on your farm, you know, you can make that farm work and use the manure. And if you've mm-hmm. got 60,000 pigs on your farm in one place, it's an environmental catastrophe.
Right.
Okay, hold on a second. So what he says is organic methods, which rely on crop rotation, manure, and compost in place of fertilizer, are far less intensive, so producing the world's current agricultural output organically would require several times as much land, and there wouldn't be much room for the rainforest now, would there? So the only place we can find the land for the farms is the rainforest. What about the suburban shopping mall? What about
maybe we'll just have to farm on the moon, Francis.
Okay, look. farming is not... It's like, oh, farming was ruining the planet until synthetic fertilizers came along. What's wrong with this guy? Okay, he also talks about how fair trade food is designed to raise poor farmers' incomes and is sold at a higher price than ordinary food with a subsidy passed back to the farmer. But he says the prices of agricultural commodities are low because of overproduction. By propping up the price, fair trade system encourages farmers to produce more of these commodities rather than diversifying into other crops. So let me give you the image this guy paints. Some poor farmer who can't afford sandals is thinking, well, if it weren't for these subsidies, I would diversify and I would grow wrist. I would make wristwatches. Okay, it's just it's this crazy cartoon view of the world.
Well,
can make a difference by what you buy. And is it perfect? No. And do we need to get involved in politics? Yes. And what he says about politics is we need a totally free trade environment. And I disagree. I disagree.
Well, one of the things that they say is that you artificially, by subsidizing these products, you are indeed having people go to those products. You're having people, you know, want to grow these products, and then thereby overproducing them, thereby creating inferior products. But the fair trade movement is a quality movement, and the whole idea here is you pay your farmers more. Okay, and when you pay your farmers more, you demand more, a higher level of quality from them sometimes.
Well, yeah, sometimes you do, but I mean, it's also because people want to see that it's not produced by slave labor, okay? Is it such a bad thing for a consumer to say, yeah, listen, I'll go for the chocolate bar that I'm sure wasn't produced by a slave, okay?
Right.
Or a 13-year-old being made to work in the hot sun.
And what they say is all of the profits don't go to the farmer. And that's true, you know. Instead of buying a $6 coffee, a $6 a pound coffee from somebody, you buy a $2 a pound coffee from somebody, and then somebody marks that up to $8 a pound instead of $4 a pound. Well, the reality is the farmer's still getting more money. He's still getting a higher percentage of his money, sometimes as much as double, triple of what he could have made.
Anyway, the end of the article, what they're suggesting is they talk about that what they want is totally free trade, regardless of what that does to people in various countries, regardless of the fact that various countries, you know, how do you have free trade when you don't have free people? You know, I have free trade with a government.
With the government, right, of North Korea, right.
Or with a farmer who, if he doesn't do what the government tells him and farm his land, he's going to get killed. Whose crops are stolen from him, whose child is forced to work. That's free trade? That's ridiculous. Anyway, but what I love, he says, what he wants is the abolition of agricultural tariffs and subsidies, most notably Europe's monstrous common agricultural policy, which coddles rich farmers and prices those in the poor world out of the European market. Okay. Have you been to Europe? It's a wonderful agricultural system, and these countries are trying to preserve their common agricultural heritage and keep farms as part of their communities, and of course it's what we should do. It's a great quality of life for them, and our agricultural subsidies, which go to rich agribusiness farmers that are corporations that are knocking our small family farmers off the farm, our subsidies are very different than those European subsidies.
You know what? This article just has... It has such a skewed point of view, but deeper in the magazine, there's a much bigger article with all sorts of things that pretend to be facts, and we're going to need to talk about it another show because we're out of time for this show. We have a guest in a few minutes, but you know, we just need to debunk all these pseudo facts that are brought.
You want to email us and ask us about this article? Give us your opinion. Maybe we'll read some of your emails on the air. It's the Economist, December 9th, page 12.
December 6th.
December
9th.
I'm
sorry.
Ethical food, good food. In the leaders, it says on the heading, the Economist magazine. Check it out. Email us at restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today, our guest is Mr. Chocolate himself, John Scharfenberger, who founded Scharfenberger Cellars, one of the premier sparkling wine cellars in the United States. He sold his interest in the winery in 1996, and he, together with his partner Robert Steinberg, started Scharfenberger Chocolates. If you haven't had chocolate, Scharfenberger Chocolate, you've been living under a rock somewhere, because it's one of the preeminent American chocolatiers, one of the preeminent American chocolates. And he's also written a book called The Essence of Chocolate, Recipes for Baking and Cooking with Fine Chocolate.
John, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's great to be here.
So, John, why couldn't you make champagne and chocolate? Why did it have to be one or the other, man?
It's good to try your hand at different things, you know. And I got to the point in the wine business where my partners, figured it out that they wanted to go on with things, and they just wanted me to kind of help sell it. And I said, oh, forget it. I'd rather help make something.
Uh-huh.
And so I moved on and was looking for another project and ran into an old friend of mine, Robert Steinberg, who had this great idea about making chocolate. And I said, oh, my gosh, it's just the same kind of thing I did when I was in the wine business. I said, you know, why does all the good champagne have to be French? And so I worked on California sparkling wine, and I did the same with chocolate. And I think we've done pretty well with our chocolate.
Well, you've really become certainly one of, if not the preeminent American chocolatiers as far as somebody actually making fine chocolate.
Well, you know, there aren't too many people actually making chocolate in the United States. I think there's 13 companies in the country.
Well,
that make chocolate.
Let's make that distinction right up front. Let's talk about the difference between being a bonbonnier and a chocolatier, someone who makes candy out of chocolate, and someone who makes the chocolate itself. Talk to us about making chocolate.
Yeah, actually, so what to make chocolate, you have to buy beans, which are cacao. Our cocoa beans, and we import these beans from all kinds of different countries, Venezuela, Ghana, Dominican Republic. They all have really interesting flavors. We put them together in different blends to make different chocolates. To actually make the chocolate, we have to roast the beans, take the shells off, grind them down with sugar. It sounds simple, but it's a lot of machinery.
Actually, no, it doesn't. It sounds like it's a heck of a lot more complicated than buying chocolate in bulk and making candies out of it.
Yeah. So a lot of people will do this. They'll actually buy cocoa mass or cocoa liquor from one of the big companies, and they'll mix up the liquor and then already partially made chocolate. And then they'll add in their own sugar and milk and all that stuff. So that's a lot of candy bars and a lot of chocolate bar companies.
I think you better tell people what chocolate liquor is.
Chocolate liquor is actually, it's also basically chocolate that's already been, made. So it's basically somebody who buys the beans and grinds them down and then sells it that way. And that's the way most chocolate makers are. So the only people who work with beans are about the 13 companies I talked about.
Why go to all that trouble to make chocolate from the bean?
Because that's where the flavor is. We really had to go all the way back to the bean, and that's where we're finding that the real difference in flavor is. So we work with different growers, and the growers tend to be villages or cooperatives, either in Venezuela or in Dominican Republic or things like this. So they're very small sources of really exquisite flavors that we buy and then can use. And I don't think you get that when you're buying somebody else's liquor.
Well, now, is it that you are able to source superior beans, or is it what you do to the beans after you get them that makes Scharfenberger chocolate different than some chocolate from a big company?
Well, I think we were just stupid when we started, and the only way we knew how to do things were the way I had done things in the wine business, which is to be really careful about flavor. So we treated the beans like we used to treat grapes. We did blind tastings, and we did lots of blind tastings and only accepted beans that had flavors that we liked. And so I think Robert and I both, kind of developed this system together where we were just very careful about it, and I think it shows in the eventual chocolate.
In the food business and in the wine business, we do a lot of things that we call blind tastings. And what a blind tasting is just what it sounds like. We don't know from where the products come from, and we'll taste 2, 3, 4, 10, 20 different products and decide which one we like the best without necessarily knowing from where they come or the origin, and then make our purchasing decisions from that.
Right, and it's a great way to go because, in a sense, you're just really honing in on where the rubber meets the road, and that's really the experience of flavor.
In the finished product with the flavors, how do you think the flavors of Scharfenberger chocolate are distinct and different from the other chocolates that are available on the market?
I don't know how they are. They just are. We have we have the flavor of cacao in our chocolate. We also don't process very heavily, so we don't have to use a lot of sugar. So we have not very sweet chocolate in general, our chocolate doesn't have a lot of sweetness.
Which means you can really do anything. Which means you can do anything you want with it. Sweet,
exactly.
Not sweet. You know, sugar is something very easy to add.
Exactly, and also not having a lot of sugar means that there's the other things have to taste good.
Mm-hmm.
So you know, sugar sort of covers.
Sugar can be a mask.
Yeah. So basically, you end up tasting a lot more chocolate.
Same thing in wine too. People use sugar as a mask.
When we come back, we're going to be talking more with John Scharfenberger about Scharfenberger chocolate in general and his book, The Essence of Chocolate. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:25.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, stage left in Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest is John Scharfenberger. Now, you know the name Scharfenberger from chocolates that you see all around. But John also has a book out called The Essence of Chocolate, Recipes for Baking and Cooking with Fine Chocolate. Now, this is a recipe book for chocolate, which is a great holiday gift, I think, or for anyone who likes chocolate, which is everyone I know. But it's not just a recipe book. There's really the story of chocolate in here. What story are you trying to tell with the book besides just giving people recipes as to how to use your chocolate?
Well, we're trying to, you know, tell the story that, you know, all the stories we've learned over the last 9 years, because having come to it, to us, everything was pretty new. So we want to let people know, you know, what we've learned about what chocolate is, where it comes from, and how we got to do what we're doing. So it's sort of all in there. We intersperse it with 130 or so great recipes using kind of these sort of modern, intense chocolate flavors that we have in our chocolate.
One of the things, and just your book obviously is a great recipe book and also a great coffee table book, but also a good cookbook at the same time, which I think it crosses a lot of lines there. But one of the things in the book that I found fascinating, just a silly little fact, is the cacao beans, they don't fall naturally. They need an animal or something else to come and take them off of the tree or they'll just sit there.
You know, it's interesting that I think the plant, you know, evolved in a very special way. It's this fruit that grows basically in a tropical rainforest, and it requires, and they're bright red and bright orange and bright yellow, so they're amazing colors. They really, you know, it takes a monkey or a tapir or whatever they evolved with, but later man, obviously, to figure out to pick these fruits and to eat them. The pulp inside, though, is delicious. So once you get onto the pulp, I think animals really got onto it. I think the beans didn't taste good. They spit them out and spread them around the jungles, and that's how chocolate spread throughout Central America.
And as it spread throughout Central America, one of the things that I think is most interesting in your book, and one of the things I want to talk with you more about after the news, is the origins of chocolate and chocolate as a ritual drink. I mean, it's kind of like coffee. Chocolate isn't exactly intuitive that we would get from the bean to what we see, you know, in the finished product and how we have chocolate today. We'll be talking more after the news with John Scharfenberger about chocolate, where it came from, and what you can do with it here today in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with Francis Schott. Together we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every Monday through Friday from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Our guest today is John Scharfenberger. He is the owner of Scharfenberger Chocolates together with his partner Robert Steinberg, and they've written a book called The Essence of Chocolate, where you've collaborated with John some of the best chefs around, like Jacques Pepin and Thomas Keller. And I want to talk more with our audience about some recipes that appear in this book and ways that we can use it today. But one of the things I like about this book is how you delve a little bit into the history of how it came to be used as we use it today. It started as a ritual drink and not necessarily sweet. You want to tell us a little bit about how we got from there to here?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. One of the places I buy chocolate from in Guatemala, they're still drinking it this way. They consume chocolate as a ritual drink. So they take these cacao beans, they roast them and grind them down with chili and vanilla and all kinds of things. They put a little fruit paste in it, so it's a little bit sweet. And then they drink it. It's got a stimulant in it, kind of similar to coffee, though it's not as strong. And so that's pretty much the way it was consumed for the last 10,000 years, and it still has been consumed that way in Central America.
And I see a new cocktail in one of our restaurants coming from this. John, maybe we'll need to send us some cacao beans.
Now, how do we get from there? How did the chocolate as we know it evolve to the way we think of chocolate as a candy?
Well, it was brought to Europe, basically because of the stimulant. You know, back in those days, they didn't have coffee or tea yet. And so the Spanish court started drinking the stuff just the way they had seen it in the Aztec court. They started drinking it. And then I think Charles III or somebody in about the 1540 or so had some sugar added to his. And I think he told his chef, you know, that's the way I want it from now on.
Mm-hmm.
It tastes pretty darn good. So the combination of sugar and chocolate together really comes from the Spanish. And so they still consumed it as a drink, but it had the sugar added to it.
Talk to us about the difference between chocolate and cocoa.
Yeah. So cocoa, cocoa is a powder, and it comes when you actually make chocolate. You make a rough chocolate in the factory, and then you put it in a press, and you press out the fat. So you're left with a powder that then you can make hot chocolate with. And then you use the cocoa butter. They can make white chocolate out of it, which we don't want to go into. A lot of cocoa butter is used in cosmetics. And so the cocoa powder you buy, you know, in those packets and stuff, is basically mixed with sugar and made into a drink. The best cocoa, basically, is though is made specifically to be drunk. And has great flavors and is really quite good.
So talk to us about drinks today. I mean, I like to make hot cocoa. My girlfriend likes hot chocolate.
Yeah.
What's the difference between the two?
Well, the first time I went out to a bar in Barcelona, you go out to a bar about 2 in the morning, and you get home around 6 in the morning, and I was coming home at 6 with a pile.
Doesn't everybody do that?
I guess it seemed like the thing to do.
We're restaurant guys. This is our life.
So everyone said, let's go get churros and chocolate. And I figured, you know, what the heck is that? I'll go with these guys. So you get in this car, and then everybody ends up at this little place, and we had things kind of like donuts or churros, and then they served us hot chocolate. But that hot chocolate wasn't made from cocoa powder. It was actually made from chocolate itself. It was actually like you take a chocolate bar, you break it up into little pieces, and you put hot water over it, and you mix it up really carefully and make a really thick drink out of it. And, boy, that was a perfect thing to have after a long night of, Barcelona night.
That's how my French grandmother used to make it. I loved
exactly.
it.
And so, really, that's the way if you like hot chocolate, that's the way you should really consume it. And, by the way, for a holiday drink, it's great with a little rum in it or a little, brandy. And it's a really sort of non-cholesterol alternative to eggnog.
Would you mind if we threw your recipe for hot chocolate up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com?
No, put it in there. It's a good one.
Great. We'll do that, and we'll credit John Scharfenberger. Now, something that I see around a lot now is I see a lot of a product called nibs, and I want to talk about those. And I also see more and more in fine restaurants people using chocolate in savory applications, like people using it in the main course, people using it in the main dish. What are your feelings on that? What do you think about that?
Well, when chocolate has been used for you know, millennia in Central America, and then it was used early in Italy early on. They didn't know to make candy out of it. They put little bits of it in their bolognese.
Right, it was savory.
So there's lots of sugos with tiny bits of chocolate, and the chocolate actually helps link the flavors between the tomato and the meat together. So it's a good ingredient. I wouldn't want it to be a main ingredient, but it's a real good kind of spice. As you were player in a lot of dishes, and it fulfills a good role there, giving a darkness to it. I use it as a cocoa powder, as a rub on flank steak and on lamb and things like that, and it's a delicious thing. It doesn't taste like chocolate; it just tastes great.
As a savory ingredient, I think that you're right there. It does make a nice background flavor to kind of in a mix of other spices.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with John Scharfenberger, the owner of Scharfenberger Chocolates, and we're talking specifically about his book, The Essence of Chocolate. Now, what are nibs? I see these around. I've been Christmas shopping recently, and I've been handed free samples of nibs around. What are nibs?
Yeah, well, nibs are actually cocoa beans that have been roasted and had their shells taken off, and they're kind of little smashed up nuts, but they're the nuts that we make chocolate out of. So it's one of the steps in our chocolate making. The cocoa beans are turned into nibs, and they're really great flavors. It's a nut that has chocolate flavor. So
but remember,
it's like a walnut or something.
Yeah, it's a nut. It's not sweet. There's no sugar added. A nib is the bean.
Yeah, so if you're going to coat it with chocolate or put it into a biscotti or something like that, it's a really great combination of flavors. And because also it hasn't been ground down and processed the way chocolate is, they also have flavors in addition to the flavors that chocolate has. So they're really quite interesting.
So, John, you know, there's a lot of talk about how similar, and Francis alluded to this earlier in the show, about how similar cocoa farming or cacao farming and coffee farming are. Do we see things happening in the chocolate world and in the cacao world that we're seeing happening in the coffee world as well?
It's a bit different in some ways that you grow coffee in cool places in the tropics, and you grow cacao in the hot, steamy parts of the jungle. They both need to be shade grown, so that's one of the similarities. But the other difference is that most cacao is actually grown by really small farmers.
Mm-hmm.
I think 80% of the world's cacao is grown on farms of like 10 acres or less. So in unlike coffee, which tends to be larger farms, cacao tends to be family farmers.
And they tend to be
very small ones.
People with not a lot of money.
And people with not a lot of money, exactly. So what we're trying to do is work more directly with farms or actually farm village groups to make cacao for us, and also work with them more directly. And if we can work with them more directly, we can, you know, obviously they make a lot more money, we get a lot better cacao, and everybody wins in the end. And that's pretty much what I'm working on.
Well, again, that goes back to the grape farmer, where the grape farmer grows better grapes, and if there's a direct relationship between the guy who's making the finished product and the guy who's making the raw, the agricultural product, and it's not sold as a commodity, you can have an old-fashioned business relationship that works better for both people. Isn't that?
Yeah, it does. And it's interesting in a lot of parts of the world where chocolate's actually grown. People don't even eat chocolate. It's not in their culture. Whereas in Guatemala, you know, they've been consuming it for 7,000 years. So it's real fun to go down there and give them my chocolate. They like it. And then they give me their chocolate, which is these drinks, which is completely different, but it's really interesting. So it's just kind of fun to sort of put our ideas together and learn from them.
Seems like a pretty good deal for both parties.
Do you ever think you'd bring those drinks to the United States? Do you think they'd have a market here?
They would have a market here, and you can make them here. They're just a little, I think it's hard to find some of the other spices that they're getting, and I think the taste for chili and chocolate is perhaps growing here a little bit more. There's a really nice turkey soup that I get a lot of times when I go down to the village I work in, Gabon, that's got a little bit of chocolate in it. It's really, simply delicious.
When we come back from the break, we're going to talk more about how you can make your turkey chocolate soup. I don't know that you're going to want to do that, but we'll talk more about that with John Scharfenberger, author of The Essence of Chocolate and owner of Scharfenberger Chocolates, in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
The place, Brooklyn, New York, post-World War II. An Italian-American woman named Kathleen Lombardi cooks for her family. What's so special about that? Well, lots. Food was central back then. Good food handed down from the traditions of two countries. Food that filled the whole house with the sweet smells of garlic, tomato, and basil. No matter when you stopped by or who you were sure to be fed and fussed over. Catherine showed her love on the plate and out of the pot. Any who were lucky enough to receive it never forgot. This is Mark Pascal from the Restaurant Guys Radio Show and Stage Left. I've just opened Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, and its mission? To live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. So come by the bar, sit by the fire. Have some fresh mozzarella and antipasto. The manicotti and tortelloni are amazing, and the veal chop will make you cry. Our wine list, of course, without parallel. We've got to live up to the standards set by Catherine Lombardi. You see, Catherine Lombardi was my grandmother. Come let me show you where I came from.
Catherine Lombardi Restaurant in New Brunswick, 732-296-9463 or catherinelombardi.com. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi. Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. We're talking with Mr. Chocolate, John Scharfenberger, owner of Scharfenberger Chocolates and author of The Essence of Chocolate, recipes for baking and cooking with fine chocolate. If you want to find out how you can get a copy of this book, you can go to our website, restaurantguysradio.com, and we'll send you that way.
Does the quality of the chocolate that we use when we cook really matter that much, John?
You know, yeah, because cooking, just like any ingredient, you use a good ingredient, you get a great result. And I think that's what is happening these days, is people are spending a little less time at home cooking. But when they do cook, they want to make better stuff. And I think that's really one, our biggest product is our baking chocolate. Because you make your old-fashioned brownie recipe out of good chocolate, and you really know the difference.
I mean, basically, what I think John's getting to here is the same thing that we say so frequently in the show. You know, you start with ingredients. If you start with the best fruit, you're going to make the best cobbler. If you start with the best chocolate, or the best cocoa beans or the best chocolate, you're going to make the best chocolate chip cookies.
And I want you all to think about this for just a moment. If you're used to making brownies out of a box, and it's all together, and you add water and an egg, and you make the brownies, and you know what? They can be pretty tasty. Think about your brownies if you buy this book, and it's not that much more difficult to just throw some Scharfenberger chocolate or some other good chocolate in there, use this book, and make real brownies, blow your mind. Well, absolutely.
And you know those recipes that we have in our book really are still one bowl recipes.
Yeah, that's the thing about it. It really is very simple, all this stuff.
You know, and that's what we've tried to do with our recipes is not grandstand with chocolate, but actually, you know, put in recipes you can make at home.
Make real food.
Yeah, exactly.
Now,
real stuff.
Let me ask you about treating when you get your chocolate home. When I buy Scharfenberger chocolate in the store, do I need to use it in a certain amount of time? Does it need to be kept fresh? Does it go bad? Does it get stale? Does it lose flavor?
You know, I think it's good for about a year. And then after that, it will lose a little bit of flavor. It won't go bad, but I think chocolate, like a lot of things, you just don't want to, it probably won't stay around. You'll probably end up eating it if you don't cook with it.
Mm.
So that's the good thing about it, is you can buy my baking bars and actually eat them.
Now, you have a number of people that collaborated with you on this book, a number of really top-quality chefs. I mean, guys who've been guests on our show before, Thomas Keller and folks like that. How was it working with those guys, and how did you get them involved in the project, and what was it like working with them and seeing them use your product?
Well, you know, because we're kind of a pretty special American chocolate maker, a lot of these people use our products in their restaurants and stuff, and so a lot of it was just going to them and saying, hey, what do you do with our stuff? Can we use that recipe? Because we wanted to get some good ideas from some other people who are professionals. So there's 200 or 300 restaurants in the United States that use Scharfenberger chocolate. And find out what they're doing with it and put the recipes that are appropriate for home use in the book.
All right, John, I want to ask you a question. Now, obviously, they're not Scharfenberger chocolates, but there are other chocolates out there now that are some of the mainstream chocolate makers, the Hershey's of the world, are putting out these what they're calling super premium chocolates. I guess they're not super premium, but premium chocolates. I guess what the niche they're trying to fill is a slot below the Scharfenberger chocolates, for instance. How do you rate those kinds of chocolates?
Well, you know, I think they're all doing a pretty darn good job, and the nice thing is the bar is raising for everybody. And I think that they're
raising the chocolate bar.
The chocolate bar is raising, and they're putting the percentages on them, which is also really quite nice. You know, to see other brands, coming up with percentages on them.
Those of us
flavors are improving as well.
We know they're just copying you, though. Yeah. Don't worry about that.
I have a comment on putting the percentage on things, and I do like to see the percentage of cocoa because you want to see how, you know, a lot of people have different preferences, and it's not like necessarily the higher the percentage of cocoa, the more you like it. It helps you determine a style of the chocolate. But I have found that a lot of, I'm thinking of a couple of names, and I won't name the brands, but there are a couple of them that have a high percentage of cocoa. They seem to be responsibly made, but I just don't like them. I don't think the chocolate is well crafted it doesn't have a good mouthfeel, and it's very one-dimensional, whereas, you know, Scharfenberger chocolates and a number of others that I respect are multi-dimensional. I mean, do you find that that's the case? Just the percentage of cocoa doesn't necessarily correlate to the quality.
I really like the chocolate we make, let's put it that way. And I'm pretty picky about what I consume, so the nice thing is I can get all the Scharfenberger I can eat, and so I stick to that.
Yeah, I can get all the Scharfenberger I can eat too, luckily, John.
And that's why we look the way we do.
You know, that's the nice thing. I'm really skinny, so I'm always trying to gain weight, and the problem is if you eat little bits of chocolate all day, you're not hungry. It's actually a good diet.
What if you eat lots of
dark chocolate all day? You're not hungry for other stuff. I'm not talking about bonbons. I'm talking about just having a piece of 70% chocolate here and a tasting of an 80% there and a 60% there. And by the end of the day, you know, you're starving for vegetables.
Yeah, but chocolate really does make you feel better, John, doesn't it?
The true
statement. I don't think anybody's ever said a true statement. I have a very good friend named Teresa, and she's just like, you know what? It doesn't matter how my day is going. Chocolate makes me feel better, and it truly does.
And when you're having a bad day, my phrase is, I run to chocolate. Anyway, John, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us about your book and your wonderful chocolates. They're great.
Okay, it's great to be with you guys. Thanks again.
Again, John Scharfenberger, his book is The Essence of Chocolate, Recipes for Baking and Cooking with Fine Chocolate. You can pick it up. It's pretty much all the way around, but we'll link it to it directly on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis, stage left and Kevin Lombardi. Love Scharfenberger chocolate. Love it.
And the book is really terrific, although I didn't want to pick on him while he was on the show.
Why would you pick on John Scharfenberger?
Well, the book is really terrific, but there's one recipe that I had a slight issue with.
What's that?
It was the chocolate and peanut butter panini.
Hmm.
And so I said, you know what? Peanut butter and chocolate, awesome together. Everybody knows that. So I had Chef follow the peanut butter and chocolate panini recipe. And all I could help thinking, and it's pretty much a let's call it a grilled cheese, except the center of the plate is chocolate and peanut butter. And I just said, you know what? The chocolate and the peanut butter are better without the bread and the frying process.
I don't know. Sounds great to me.
It was, chocolate and peanut butter are great. It's one of the ultimate conceptions of our time.
You know,
okay.
Funny.
Two great tastes that taste great together.
Do you know what I recall?
What do you recall?
I recall, and it just occurred to me now, you making s'mores with Scharfenberger chocolate or other fine chocolate really takes your s'mores and you go, oh,
that's
now
what
I
they're
get
supposed
it.
To taste
the
like.
The quality
exactly.
of ingredients is amazing, and I will remember one of the classic Francis moments where you looked at me like, you are so Francis. We were out at Whole Foods.
Uh-huh.
And when we went, they have the peanut butter maker there. Like, you turn it on and it grinds into peanut butter. And they had honey-roasted peanuts to make honey-roasted peanut butter that you could buy. And I bought some. And you bought some. And you were shopping for your family of four. You had, like, 9 bags. I helped you. I had one little thing. And
I
all I had in it was a thing of a high cocoa content Scharfenberger chocolate bar. And the peanut butter that we had just made that was still warm from the mashing of the nuts. And you're like, oh, what are you going to do with that? And I took the Scharfenberger chocolate and I dipped it in the fresh-made honey-roasted peanuts. And you're like, oh, you're so decadent. And you said that. but then you ate half of my peanut butter
and half of my chocolate. Yes, sir, that's me.
In the parking lot.
I want you to understand something, Francis, that I thrive on your decadence. Okay, I love your decadence. Though I mock you for it, I'm going to always eat half your peanut butter and half your chocolate.
All I am is someone for you to blame. I hope you enjoy the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 12 noon.